Has World War Begun? When I was a little boy in Eugene, Oregon in 1941, I knew very little about what was happening in Europe. I was only 11, but I so well remember when my mother was doing the laundry, and in those days we had what was called bluing, some of you women remember that, and when we rinsed the clothing, we had a great big deep two-section lead tub, and she would put the clothing in and pour in some bluing. And I would operate the old hand crank wringer. We didn't have an automatic one, so it couldn't catch your necktie and choke you like some people have had happen to them. And she would feed the clothing in, and I would crank the wringer and put them in the basket, and then she let me have the task of going out and hanging them up on the clothesline way before the day of any kind of a dryer. All of a sudden, the broadcast was interrupted. The Japanese had bombed someplace called Pearl Harbor. In my little boy's mind, I've never heard of Pearl Harbor. I thought perhaps it was up somewhere around Portland in Oregon, which is a major port accessible to the Pacific from the Columbia River. I had no idea where Pearl Harbor was. The closest harbor I knew of was over on the Oregon coast. But as I began listening to the broadcast, my mother became very, very concerned and called the office to get a hold of my dad. And I ran next door to an old fellow in the block that we all called Grandpa. He was no relation of mine, but he told me very quickly, "Oh, Teddy, don't worry about it. Those little yellow guys over there, little yellow Jap dwarfs, said we'll just send our Pacific fleet over there and we will completely surround their little bitty island and we will starve them out in only 6 weeks' time." So I felt fairly reassured. But I went out and collected bottles that afternoon, and they used to give us up to 3 cents for some of the large quart bottles. And I got 11 cents eventually, which was enough to go to the movie, and I walked downtown and went to the movie. They were showing a movie called Penrod about a kid that was very daring, and he got into a hot air balloon and cast off the weights, and there he goes soaring into the sky is all I remember. But every now and then they would type a little piece of paper and insert it into the screen with war news. And now they began to admit that some people had been killed and some ships had been damaged. We learned later that what old Grandpa told me was pure Grandma's applesauce. The Pacific Fleet didn't exist anymore. So the Pacific Fleet wasn't about to surround the little bitty yellow island and starve them into submission because it lay on the bottom of Pearl Harbor. Lots of our battleships had been sunk or heavily damaged or turned turtle or grounded. So I was introduced to war. But had I really realized what was happening when I was only three, and when I was four, and I looked at the pattern on the old worn-out rug as I listened to BBC over shortwave and heard a man called Adolf Hitler screeching and screaming and ranting and raving, had I known in 1938, when I was only a boy of eight, that Hitler sent troops into the Rhineland, and they marched across the Rhine bridges into what then was a DMZ. You're familiar with that because of North and South Korea, the 38th parallel, and the DMZ that used to exist between North and South Vietnam. A demilitarized zone. According to the Treaty of Versailles, the Rhineland, which was an area which had been much disputed, the other side of Aachen, was between both France and Germany a disputed area, but most of them were ethnic Germans. The Treaty of Versailles had included that it required that that remain a demilitarized zone. The Western Allies had decided that they would go along with Hitler's demands and at least withdraw their occupying troops. So the British and the French troops backed out of the Rhineland in 1937. In 1938, Hitler marched in, but he gave orders that when he did, they were to put daisies in their rifle barrels, and they were met with great cheers and great, great ecstatic excitement by the populace of the towns along the Rhine. And he gave specific orders because the Wehrmacht at that time was only 1/4 the size of the French army. But the French army sat behind the Maginot Line, totally geared to a defensive posture. The idea of an offensive attack against Hitler never occurred to any of them, apparently. But if you can imagine it, the brashness and the boldness of the man who decided the Western Allies, America, Britain, would do nothing and challenged the French and marched into the Rhineland. Was that what started World War II? Was it started when Hitler came to power? Was it started in the next few months, a year and a half or so, when Neville Chamberlain went down after Hitler's demands about the nearly 3 million, 2,800,000 to be exact, ethnic Germans, does that ring a bell today? ethnic groups living inside a nation next to the borders of another nation where they had gradually emigrated and grown and their families and expanded and enlarged until the entire western side of the then Czechoslovakian Republic was occupied by ethnic Germans. They had it better than anybody else in Czechoslovakia. They had almost a socialist welfare state. They had things like free education, and they were just really well off. But Joseph Goebbels, that doctor of propaganda, had made it seem like they were being very harshly mistreated. And so with a lot of lies and fabrications, they acted like the majority of the Czechs were mistreating the minority in Czechoslovakia of ethnic Germans and German-speaking people. So Hitler said he was going to invade and even set a date. Going to occupy that. We're not going to tolerate this any further. Well, Neville Chamberlain, you know, came back to London waving the famous white paper saying it is peace in our time. Well, there were lots of other people like the Poles to the north and the Hungarians over to the east. And they were looking at some of the very luscious valleys and the provinces and so on of Czechoslovakia. And so when Neville Chamberlain allowed that paper to be signed in Munich, they partitioned Czechoslovakia, and everybody began to get a piece of the pie. I had written down the exact amounts of the square miles to tell you about. Hitler full well knew that Britain and France would never go to war over the Sudetenland. And so when the Munich Pact was signed on September 29th of 1938, he said he was going to occupy it on the 1st of October if they didn't get out. He said, and I quote, "Once the Sudeten problem," this is Adolf Hitler and his promises, quote, "once the Sudeten problem is settled, no territorial problem in Europe will remain. It is the last territorial demand I have to make in Europe. This I guarantee. We want no Czechs at all." They only wanted to protect the ethnic Germans. Poland then moved in and gobbled up 625 square miles of Czechoslovakia, 230,000 people. Hungary moved in and gobbled up an area of 7,500 square miles of 775,000 population. These were age-old difficulties along borders where people said, "That's mine." "No, it's not. It's mine." And so under the aegis of Adolf Hitler's minions and the occupation of the Sudetenland, the other nations moved in. One leader of Czechoslovakia said to Neville Chamberlain, "If you have sacrificed my nation in order to bring about world peace, then perhaps God would understand. But if that is not what happens, may God forgive you." When did World War II start? On December 7, 1941? That's what a lot of Americans think. But no, not really. It was a very short time then before a lot of other excuses and big lies, including a deliberate incursion across Poland by a group of German Wehrmacht soldiers dressed up by Poles. I said into Poland, it should have been the other way. A little radio station in the German border was deliberately sabotaged by German soldiers dressed like Poles. They needed a pretext, but long before that, they had massed armor on the Polish border. And so in October of 1939, bombs began falling on Warsaw, and German armored columns began to advance on Poland. But behind the scenes, at Locarno and before, there had also been pacts between Stalin and Hitler, and they agreed in a non-defense treaty, or a mutual defense pact, a mutual non-aggression pact, where neither one would attack the other if they partitioned Poland. And so Russia got about half of Poland, and Germany got the other half, under the pretext that the Danzig Corridor was unfair. The Danzig Corridor was a narrow corridor leading to the port of Danzig, which was primarily ethnic German, as a result of the Treaty of Versailles. The Treaty of Versailles stripped Germany of the Marshalls and the Gilberts, stripped Germany of all the East African colonies that it had at that time. We know them as Kenya and Tanzania and Nyasaland and so on, and gave them to Britain, and of course imposed tremendous reparations, multiple hundreds of millions of dollars in reparations, so that Germany was desperately poor. Well, you can go back and read that, as I've done time and again. I have whole encyclopedias about World War II and pictorial as well as written and all kinds of history books, and I've read literally hundreds of books about that period. But when you read all of the events that were taking place just prior to World War II, of how the London Treaty was scrapped, of how the Japanese secretly had built huge battleships far bigger than were allowed by the London Naval Treaty, how the nations were arming with the exception of the United States. We were isolationist. Our two big oceans would protect us. We knew virtually nothing about what was going on in Europe. The Mediterranean was in flames. The Balkans were in flames. Hitler then went around the Maginot Line through Belgium, the Ardennes, and attacked France, as we know, and completely surrounded the British, the BEF, British Expeditionary Force. And because of the stupidity of Hitler's, who allowed Goering with his great boast to say that the Luftwaffe would single-handedly completely annihilate the British army that was stuck on the shores of Dunkirk, he called off the armored columns and gave them a couple of days, and then a fantastic miracle occurred. The world's choppiest, most storm-tossed waters, the world's most treacherous waters with all kinds of conflicting currents, the English Channel was dead calm for the better part of 2 days. And every little boat that any Briton could lay his hands upon, including little rowboats and motorboats with even, you know, five-horse motors on them with extra cans of gasoline, went across that 20 miles and brought the bulk of the British BEF back from Dunkirk. They were vulnerable. They could have been wiped out virtually to a man. By the time the British were hunkered down in their little island and the battle for Britain, as it was called, had begun, this is 1940. America had no intention of getting into the war. But Roosevelt, contrary to our own policies, secretly raided all of the National Guard armories, including the little one in Eugene, Oregon, of the old Springfield 30-06, 03s, of all kinds of machine guns and mortars, mostly small arms and ammunition, stripped them bare virtually all over the United States and sent trucks secretly to Canada, where they went across the Canadian border. This was worked out between Churchill and Roosevelt so that they could arm at least a home guard or a militia in Britain, because Britain left all of its equipment on the shores of France. It was practically stripped of tanks and lorries, as they called them, and all the various other equipment like the bulldozers and all of the kinds of trucks and vehicles that the army would have needed. And they were reduced to practically an armless nation, no arms there. Well, you know all the story about the 50 World War I Forrestacker submarines, I should say destroyers. I won't go into all of that. But I just wanted to remind you a little bit about all these various events. And it's very hard to point to any one particular event to say that is when World War II started. The same thing can be said when you study the history about World War I. Was it really the assassination of Franz Ferdinand in the streets of Yugoslavia in Sarajevo that triggered that, or was that an excuse? The history books say it was all an excuse. If you look at the fact then that the nations were arming, they were forming pacts, the Austro-Hungarian Empire was really showing its muscle, and Russia was on edge, and everybody is building up huge armies all over the world, you know that it's hard to put your finger on any one particular event that triggered World War. World War II, which we think of as lasting from December 7, 1941 till about August of 1945, actually began at least in 1938. Because the events that were triggered by Hitler himself, first of all, and later on Stalin and others, led to ever-widening wars in the region, which eventually caused the entire world to get involved. Looking at the other part of the world for a minute, China had been invaded by Japan way long before. There was an incident at a bridge called Mukden in 1924. There was the attack on the gunboat, the American gunboat, in the Yellow River called, Yangtze River perhaps, called the Panay, you may remember, when it was machine gunned, allegedly, mistakenly, by Japanese aircraft. Well, because of the nationalist movement in China, as opposed to the communist movement in China, and the so-called ABCD powers, American, Britain, China, and Dutch, and the Japanese incursions into the mainland of China and the bombing of some of their cities, we had the pictures of little Chinese guys there with the bombs blasting all around, sitting there crying, one of the most famous pictures of World War II. The United States decided, Roosevelt decided, to try to order the Japanese out of China. And so we clamped down an embargo upon them. But the Chinese and the Japanese have been locked in war for years, since the late 1920s. And China was almost a quarter occupied by Japan. The Japanese had invaded China, and they had just made tremendous territorial progress in China. And so in order to try to slap them on the wrist and to curtail war in that region, Roosevelt decided to cut off all of the really strategic flow of materials to Japan. But Japan is a bicycle economy. It does not have the natural reserves it needs to survive. It had to trade. And the tin, the oil, and the rubber, some of the most essential components for its war machine, came from the Dutch East Indies. So when the British, the Dutch, and the Americans clamped an embargo, we froze all Japanese assets in U.S. banks. We halted a tremendous flow of scrap iron upon which they depended. They had, based upon the reserves and the big oil tanks and all the stockpiles inside the nation of Japan, a two-year margin of survival under normal peacetime conditions. But in the heightened wartime conditions and a voracious demand of bunker fuel for their navy and of aviation gas for their air corps, that would have only lasted them for 1 year. The instant that the ABCD powers clamped that embargo upon the Dutch East Indies and all British possessions such as Brunei and the American possessions in the Philippines, and trade with Japan came to an absolute halt, where before all the Marus, the big waddling fat tankers and cargo carriers were just festooning the seas, now all of a sudden it was down to a bare trickle. They knew they had 1 year to survive as a nation before Japanese people began to starve. And so they attacked the U.S. fleet in order to buy time to move south and to move to their west. They had no intention of occupying Honolulu, no matter what you swore, what you heard sworn to on the part of some military types. And they had no intention of invading the west coast. The Japanese would have exhausted themselves trying to garrison California. No way. It was never in their plan. They wanted the Philippines. They wanted the Dutch East Indies. They wanted Malaysia. They wanted the tin and the rubber. And they wanted to consolidate an empire all the way to Australia. Yes, they did want New Guinea and Australia. And the islands were merely a means of getting air bases and naval bases to hop down there to accomplish that eventually. Witness their bombing of Darwin and Port Moresby, and the fact that the Owen Stanley Mountains pretty much stopped them, as well as American attack into the Solomons and Guadalcanal. Well, enough of World War II, just to remind you about that. Has World War III already begun? You will look back and wonder. I want to read to you a couple of things that came in that are, I think, very important. Some things being said here on certain websites that are important that I cannot say myself, but if you ever hear other people phrase things and put them into words you wish you had said, this is that type of thing. This comes from the Capitol Hill Blue website by Doug Thompson and the Reagan Interchange Information, or Information Interchange rather, HTTP and then www.reagan.com. This is the son of Ronald Reagan, who maintains his own website. Here's an interesting article that came through just the other day. Bill Clinton's failing Kosovo war is part of a desperate, dangerous, and fatally flawed plan by a scandal-ridden president to salvage a legacy for the history books, White House and Pentagon insiders say. In fact, the president is willing to risk a global military conflict to shift the emphasis on his presidency away from the many scandals that have dogged his administration, interviews with present and past White House and Pentagon staff members reveal. Interviews conducted over the past 2 weeks show an increasingly isolated president whose obsession with his place in the history books has led him to ignore the recommendations of not only career officers, but also many of his own close aides. Quote, "The president is standing alone on a lot of this," said one White House aide. "He's finding fewer and fewer people who are willing to stick with him over Kosovo. He's backed himself, his administration, and his country into a corner." The two who are sticking with Clinton are National Security Advisor Sandy Berger and Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. Some are calling her now Madeleine Halfbright, who aides say would follow Clinton anywhere. Berger and Albright put their loyalty to Clinton above their oaths to serve the Constitution, said a military analyst, Sander Owen. It's pathetic to watch. At the Pentagon, senior officers now call the president, quote, "the draft dodger in chief," end quote, and sneer at his inability to grasp simple military tactics. I looked at a poll this morning. I voted in that poll. The question was, did Madeleine Albright miscalculate the effects of NATO airstrikes on Kosovo? Out of all of those many thousands of people who polled, it was 93% said yes, and 7% said no. 93% of the American public polled said Madeleine Albright had completely miscalculated. I'll read a little more on that in a moment. One career officer in the Pentagon said of Clinton, "The man is an ass. He has no concept of military operations. To him, it's a video game. What we don't know is how many body bags it will take to make this jerk face reality," end quote. Now, these people spoke on the idea that they would be anonymous because they don't want their careers ruined, neither do they want to have something worse happen to them. Arnold Crittenden, a retired intelligence analyst, said Clinton has become a, quote, laughingstock in both the military and intelligence communities. His political motives are so blatant that they would be farcical if we weren't talking about the lives of American soldiers, Crittenden said. There wasn't that much respect for the man to begin with, and what little there was is long gone now. Clinton, who often turns to history to justify his actions, has told aides that Richard Nixon, who resigned from office in the Watergate scandal, will be remembered more for his foreign policy accomplishments than the scandal that ended his presidency. "There's a real irony here," said one White House staffer. "The president's troubles have often been compared with those of Nixon. Now he's using Nixon as a model to justify his actions in Kosovo." Aides say that Clinton started focusing more on foreign policy when it became clear he would not be convicted in the Senate impeachment trial. Before that time, what did you hear? Social Security, Medicaid and Medicare, education, 100,000 policemen. What did you hear? What did you hear? Give to the American people, give more, give more, give more, more peace, more plenty, more prosperity. You didn't hear much about foreign policy. Is that a valid statement? He wanted to find some foreign policy arena where a bold stroke would showcase his administration as a world leader, one former aide in the White House says. When it became clear that he was focusing on Kosovo, a lot of people tried to talk him out of it. But Bill Clinton is a man who won't let go of something once he focuses on it. He was sure that defeating a tyrant would restore his place in history. But military planners told Clinton he could not win a limited air war in Kosovo. The president was advised that his strategy was flawed, and he ignored that advice. This is from policy.com. The blame game, Albright's Kosovo legacy. An ardent advocate of forceful action in Yugoslavia, Secretary of State Madeleine Albright has found herself in the midst of a political firestorm as the death toll rises in Kosovo and the political risks to NATO members escalate with no clear end in sight to the Balkan conflict. Albright's role in expanding NATO action in Kosovo is now a focal point of many critics who accuse the Secretary of State for failing to fully comprehend the possible consequences of NATO military airstrikes. As the nation's top diplomat, Isaiah 3:16, Albright has repeatedly expressed her concern about the situation in the Balkans and advocated a strong approach to dealing with the region's ethnic conflict. In particular, she suggested that Yugoslavian President Slobodan Milosevic would respond to the threat of force. Albright's assumptions were based on the fact that the Yugoslavian forces appeared to back down last fall in the light of possible NATO strikes. That was in the Washington Post. In the day just before the NATO strikes, the State Department officials predicted that multilateral action would substantially weaken Milosevic's hold on the region within a relatively short time frame. How long has it been now? Going on toward a month. Over 3 weeks. How much do our military planners and those advisors closest to the president know? How much did Madeleine Albright really know? But then, wasn't Neville Chamberlain an intelligent man? Wasn't the British Parliament a conservative body? Didn't they believe Adolf Hitler when he said, "I have no territorial demands other than the Sudetenland, and once that is complete, I have no more territorial demands in Europe"? Incredible, isn't it? How lack of knowledge, sometimes ego, sometimes hidden agendas, and sometimes just plain ignorance and miscalculation, back nations into war. Albright argued that military strikes would likely last a few weeks, sharply conflicting Defense Department predictions made weeks prior to initial NATO attacks, which said it would take a lot longer than that. As the conflict in the Balkans appeared to grow increasingly worse in Kosovo, the Clinton administration reportedly was surprised by how fast the situation deteriorated. And as more refugees fled from Kosovo, swamping border crossings in Macedonia and Albania, critics blamed Albright for her role in expanding the conflict without fully understanding the consequences of NATO military action and labeled the conflict Albright's war. And so our bombs have done what? They have solidified Yugoslav people behind Slobodan Milosevic, including many who couldn't stand the man, including my own daughter-in-law's family, her mother and her sister who are over there in Novi Sad, who couldn't stand him, didn't vote for him and didn't like him. It's caused all the Yugoslav people to coalesce together in tremendous support, Slobodan Milosevic. Secondly, it caused him to speed up his pogroms, if you can call them that, or his program of complete ethnic cleansing. And there is a twin reason why those people are fleeing. People, of course, don't lock themselves in their own trains. Many of them have fled NATO bombing, but they've also fled because they've been ordered out at gunpoint, and they are discovering now from the air at least two, perhaps three, mass graves. It'll never be determined whether or not that is what those are until people are there on the ground. Now Europe is saying perhaps there should be a separate multilateral European force because this is a European problem that should go in there. The United Nations is saying, no, it ought to be under the aegis of the UN. We know now that a tripartite pact has been signed between Belarus, who had earlier eschewed any kind of deployment of nuclear missiles and A-bombs on their soil following their breakaway from the Soviet Union and their complete independence, and they didn't want to be under Soviet domination any further. But now, because Yeltsin and the president of Belarus have been talking, and the Yugoslav parliament recently passed a pact, those three nations are solidly together in a mutual pact which says that one nation will come to the defense of the other, paving the way for Russia's entry into the conflict if she chooses to do so. At least three times, Boris Yeltsin has said, Bill Clinton may have triggered World War III. Is Boris Yeltsin a man to be taken note of? Does he know what's going on in his country? Oh, well, the CIA says he's just saying that now. He's rattling the saber now. He's threatening to get Russia involved now to quiet some of his constituency and some of the people in the Soviet in Russia, such as Lebed and Zhirinovsky and other people who are warmongers and hawks who want to get into the conflict right now and send columns of Russian tanks down there. And, of course, far more air defenses, their surface-to-air SAMs and so on. Lebed has called for that, and Zhirinovsky, as you know, sent some trainloads of mercenaries down there who have already arrived in Belgrade. They were staged in Novi Sad for some days, but they're now filtering all over the country to buttress some of the Yugoslavian forces. Now, in the meantime, around the world, if you look at what is happening, if you ask where are we right now today, all you've got to look at is the problem between North and South Korea, the problems in China, the problems between Pakistan and India, the problems in the Middle East between the PA and the Israelis, and of course, ongoing war in Kosovo and Yugoslavia. And if you look at all of that in perspective, it's quite a bit on your plate, isn't it? Just the other day, missiles were being fired by the Indians and the Pakistanis, where earlier, some very few months ago, they had both experimented with underground nuclear blasts, each one threatening the other, and then backing off a little bit. Now they're launching missiles to prove to each other, I can send my nuclear weapons to your big cities if I wish and bomb you into extinction. And those people, because they are Hindus and Sikhs and Muslims, hate one another. They're divided because of religion. East and West Pakistan were divided following World War II because of the majority of the Hindus in India proper and the minorities of the Islamic believers in both East and West Pakistan, now called Pakistan and Bangladesh. That was divided up after World War II, as you recall. Iran, testing rockets and missiles. Iraq, even today, northern and southern no-fly zones being patrolled by F-16s and by British Tornadoes and others every single day, and every now and then another attack by one of the air defense units who will bring on their what's called fire can radars and maybe begin to track an American aircraft, which will then detect the signal and send a missile right down to the radar site if they dare to turn them off. So that's an ongoing conflict in Iraq. Then you look at North and South Korea. North Korea is practically prostrate as a result of a prolonged drought. Hundreds of thousands have died. It is desperately poor. It covets what the South has. South Korea, with the capital of Seoul, is one of the huge cities of the world. It is a gigantic, vibrant economy. It exports a tremendous amount to all of Europe and the United States. North Korea covets it, and they've got these age-old antagonisms that could burst into open warfare at any time. If I were the leader, Kim Il-sung, of North Korea, and I wanted to invade the South, I couldn't begin to dream of a better time than right now. Do you think prior to Hitler's demands against the Sudetenland that either Bulgaria or Poland would have demanded and simply moved their armed forces into 700, whatever it was, the square miles I told you, of Czechoslovakian territory without other nations around reacting? No, they seized the opportunity. Look at China. She has now begun to send three-stage solid rockets. Before, they only had one-stage or two-stage liquid-fueled rockets. Now sending three-stage solid-fueled rockets up into space and launching even satellites. The guidance technology that China now enjoys came from the United States. The heightened trade that China enjoys came from the United States. Every single year, the Congress votes the Chinese most favored trade status. I don't know that there is anything to the story about the Riyadis or about some of the Chinese connection, about finance money for campaigns. I don't know what there is to the story of the spy out there in New Mexico who allegedly took a lot of secrets over to China, or about one of the deals which allegedly was purely for commercial purposes for the satellite guidance systems, because China wanted to put communication satellites up there in orbit or in a stationary orbit to help its telephonic and instant communication system in China. And so our very great American experts in that field gave them the technology, and it was all for peaceful purposes so that their missiles would be more accurate. Well, now 14 to 18, they say, huge, big Chinese ICBMs are aimed at American cities. Notwithstanding what our president said in the State of Union address when he said, tonight there is not one single missile aimed at an American child. At the time, there were, he knew it, but then he has not been that careful with the truth through much of his life. So that's where we are today. I want to read to you a few headlines right quickly. This came just yesterday from Judy Sellers, who has a news service and sends me all of these headlines that I select certain ones to use for World Watch. Pentagon wants to call up 33,000 reservists. Another headline, this is why I know we're soon going to be having a draft. If not soon, this year, in a few months, by next year, but probably before the fall, because Vice President Al Gore said, we're not going to have a draft. That's why I feel we will have a draft. Russian Parliament votes for union with Yugoslavia. Britain says NATO airstrikes to intensify. What are they going to hit next? They've been hitting schools and apartment complexes and residential areas. They've been hitting heating plants. They've been hitting water filtration plants and purification plants. They've been bombing bridges so people can't go to work. They've been destroying civilian infrastructure. They've been killing hundreds of civilians. They've been bombing trains with civilians aboard. And they're going to intensify the campaigns. But in our breast-beating, hair-shirted Baptist self-righteousness, we as a nation decided a long time ago, we eschew assassination as a foreign policy, as a weapon of foreign politics. We will never go after the bad guy. And so every day, sitting there in his palatial presidential palace, right in downtown Belgrade, is Slobodan Milosevic, and he is receiving people from anywhere from Cyprus to Russia to Belarus, or wherever they come from. And they don't even begin to think about bombing that place where that man sits. Of course, he won't stay there just in case they go back on our word. He probably hides out and goes around from bunker to bunker just like Saddam Hussein did. But isn't that one of the dumbest policies you ever heard? Kill innocent people, most of whom voted against him anyway. And he sits there and finds that his support is consolidating. He's being helped by the NATO bombing and can emerge as a powerful, you know, he can declare martial law if he hasn't already. It consolidates your power when you're being attacked from without. Suddenly you can abolish Parliament if you want, and you can get your people to do anything they want to do. Now, he's got to look out because he doesn't want the Russians to come down there and occupy them. You've got to realize that Josip Tito, for the bulk of all of these decades following World War II, who, while he was a communist, was far more of a nationalist than a communist, and he never did sign a pact such as now has been signed by the Yugoslav Parliament with Russia. Not in all of those years. Josip Tito was a communist, but he was not dominated by the Soviet Union. And so Milosevic doesn't want to be dominated by the Soviet Union or by Russia either. Ethnic cleansing brutally intensified. The Serb aim is to expel all Kosovar Albanians, says someone. Well, what do you know? There's a headline to tell you that. NATO admits mistakenly bombing civilians. It was amazing to me the other day when it was showing the actual train there. And before that, it was showing that's the first time I shouted a thing on my TV set in a long time, but it was showing the convoy and the bodies scattered around. And then it flashed on this general in NATO, and he was saying, well, we have no information to demonstrate whether or not that really happened. And so I shouted to my TV set, why don't you turn on your television set and look, because you can see the evidence right in front of your eye. But they have been a little fast and loose with the truth at NATO headquarters, too. Unless you think that we in the Western world get only the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, if those words ring a bell, it's not my fault, on our television every time we see the news. Clinton says bomb errors are inevitable and regrettable. Cohen, prospect of American casualties high, beginning to prepare us for all of this. Earth will burn, warns Milosevic. U.S. says Yugoslavia has chemical weapons. Germany affirms NATO's support and invites Russia to take part in a solution. FBI warns of Serb terrorism in the United States. Russia and China warn the United States that another arms race is beginning. The State Department refuses to recognize Jerusalem as a part of Israel. There's a real coup for Madeleine. The Jewish state has been ensconced in Jerusalem for years. And they say it is their eternal capital. And Teddy Kollek, who was the mayor of Jerusalem, told me when I interviewed him several years ago, we will never give up one inch. He said, not one inch. Their government buildings are there. The Knesset is there. The head of state is there. And Madeleine says, we don't recognize that as your capital. Why? Arabs have oil. America needs oil. Does that ring a bell? Arabs are Islamic. Arabs are in support of the PA, the Palestinian Authority. We wouldn't want to do anything to irritate any Arabs if we can. And so Madeleine Albright, Secretary of State, says that our State Department refuses to recognize Jerusalem, Israel, as the capital or even as a part of Israel. That's far more significant, isn't it? It's not even part of Israel. The Pope has been calling for decades for what is called a corpus separatum, or an internationalized city where Jerusalem is separate from, like the District of Columbia or Distrito Federal, as they say at Mexico City, and is not really like a part of the state, but different from our District of Columbia, which is certainly a part of the United States. They want it to be an internationalized city under control of the Vatican, which would have complete control of the holy places and allow free access, allegedly, to all faiths. U.S. continue to pressure regarding Yeshua communities, or the settlements in the West Bank. Iraq says it opened fire at Western Plains. Moscow to provide advanced defense system to Iran and Iraq, making money by sending SAMs over there. Arafat concludes Arab and international tour, prepares for a decision on declaration of an independent state. They say it's going to come in May, but they're not sure now. Sharon foresees severe water crisis in Israel. India fires new missile. Pakistan conducts second missile test. Agreement signed on Russian base in Tajikistan. The Vatican warns Israel against permitting the building of a mosque in Al-Nasira. Astronomers discover new three-planet solar system. Natural disasters devastate China. Colombian landslides kill many. Fires destroy homes in eastern Florida. 6.6 earthquake strikes near Fiji, etc., etc., etc. That's enough of the headlines. Now, where are we in Bible prophecy? We know that Jesus Christ said we would be living in a time of wars and rumors of wars. And I have talked about that for literally decades. There have been more than 65 wars since World War II. But with the conditions in the world today and United States' response to them, and the fact that we are now engaged either in peacekeeping activities or as a garrison of other areas that have known our wrath, such as Panama, etc., around the world, that the United States forces are now garrisoning 28 different places in the world. We have depleted our ordnance. We depleted our military hardware. Every single cruise missile costs the same amount of money as a used Learjet. With this nice little television camera in the nose, so you can actually see the civilian train as it disintegrates on the bridge. You saw that on TV the other day, I would imagine. So it's just like throwing so many Learjets. Well, they rationalize that because they say dumb bombs, as we had in World War II, would cost far more because they don't hit their target very often. They splatter all over the landscape and be an awful lot more, as they call, collateral damage, and it sure would if they use that kind of bombing. And so they get more bang for the buck by sending the equivalent of a Learjet right down the elevator shaft into a particular building they want to hit, and they say that the accuracy is incredible. And it is, even though they still go astray. If we find out what God says in the Word of God about what America is going to undergo in the next few years, it will just about curl our hair. Now, first of all, I will say before I begin in some of these scriptures that I know that the United States is Manasseh and that Britain, a great company of nations, is Ephraim. And the key to understanding biblical prophecy, especially the book of Ezekiel and many of these prophecies, is the identity of the 10-tribed Israel, the lost 10 tribes, the house of Israel, in Bible prophecy. But here's my little disclaimer. Even if you didn't believe that, if we in our self-righteousness have decided through our government to select Kosovo and ethnic cleansing with a specter of mass graves and massive deportations and even mass murder, and go to war and send tremendous numbers of our aircraft, hundreds of them, and probably later on tens of thousands of our young men on the ground, what do you think our response would be to a chemical or a biological attack against Israel, the modern state of Israel? Would the United States be involved if some other foreign enemy, whether some of those that said for many decades that Russia was the beast and Russia would attack into Palestine, and they were wrong? But even assuming they're right, what would our response be? You know that if Russia attacked Palestine, that would trigger World War III. We'd be in it immediately because the United States and the Western allies, Britain and so on, would immediately respond because the world is not going to tolerate another Holocaust. So, even though I'm saying that the identity of Israel and the house of Judah are the keys to unlock biblical prophecy, even if you didn't know that, you do know geopolitically that any major attack against the population of Israel, which would result in mass death, chemically, biologically, or even as a nuclear attack in the nation of Israel, that the United States would be instantly, wholly, completely involved. Now, having said that, let's turn to Ezekiel 5, 6, and 7. Let me turn to the fourth chapter right quickly and give you a little bit here. Ezekiel was told to take a tile and to lie there and to play act by making a sketch on a flat tile of the city of Jerusalem, chapter 4 and verse 1. Take a tile and portray upon it the city, even Jerusalem, and lay siege against it, and build a fort against it, and cast them out against it. Set the camp also in the battering rams round about. So it's like a boy playing in the yard, portraying a city, digging little ditches, making fortifications, taking little sticks, making them look like battering rams and vehicles, and setting an army in array against a tile with a picture of a city drawn upon it, which would have been inimitable, and anyone would have recognized it, and he had a lot of people who came to wonder what he was doing. Moreover, verse 3, take you an iron pan and set it for a wall of iron between you and the city. So it was like he was putting a barrier between himself and the city. And set your face against it, and it shall be besieged, and you shall lay siege against it. This shall be a sign to the house of Israel. Where was Ezekiel? He was in a town called Kabur that I think probably was a corruption of Heber, meaning a resettlement refugee camp along a river in what is modern-day northern Iraq, up in the area of Kurdistan. That's where he was. Because long before, 120 years before, Israel had fallen captive. They had all been deported. The last man jack of them, except those that shared a border with Judah, such as Benjamin. But the bulk of all the northern 10 tribes had long since been removed from that land. Jerusalem was under siege. The bulk of the tribes of Judah, of the tribe of Judah, had also been deported. You'll lie upon your left side and lay the iniquity of the house of Israel upon it. And then he talked about appointing a day for a year, the last of verse 6. Now notice chapter 5. Son of man, take you a sharp knife, take you a barber's razor, and cause it to pass upon your head and upon your beard. Then take balances to weigh and divide the hair. You shall burn with fire a third part in the midst of the city. So he piled the hair up on the tile, and he set fire to it. When the days of the siege are fulfilled, and you shall take a third part, and you hold it up with a sharp knife, and you start smiting it. So you're just chopping it into little bits and pieces. And you smite about it with a knife. Now the remaining part, you simply throw up and let the wind blow it away. You scatter it in the wind, and I will draw out a sword after them. You shall also take thereof a few in number, and bind them in your skirts, and take of them again, and cast them into the midst of the fire, and burn them in the fire. For thereof shall a fire come forth into all the house of Israel. And that seemed to imply to some people, those who were not worthy of a place of protection, it would be taken out and thrown back into the great tribulation. Thus saith the Lord Eternal, this is Jerusalem. But notice chapter 4 and verse 3, this shall be a sign to the house of Israel. Jerusalem is never called the house of Israel. The house of Judah and the house of Israel are never confused. They are always totally separate. I have said in the midst of the nations and countries that are round about her, she has changed my judgments into wickedness more than the nations, and my statutes more than the countries that are round about her, for they refused my judgments and my statutes, and they have not walked in them. Therefore, he says in verse 8, I, even I, am against thee, and will execute judgments in the midst of thee in the sight of the nations, and I will do in thee that which I have not done, and whereunto I will not do any more the like, because of all thine abominations. What does that call to mind? He's never done it before, and he will never do it again. Matthew 24, 21 to 22, then shall be a time of trouble such as was not from the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor ever indeed shall be. Daniel 12, 1, then shall be a time of trouble such as before there was a nation to that time, no, nor ever again shall be. I will do unto you that which I have not done, and whereunto I will not do any more the like, because of all your abominations. Therefore the fathers, this is ugly going here, but it's what God's word says, shall eat the sons in the midst of thee, and the sons shall eat their fathers. And I will execute judgments in thee, and the whole remnant of thee will I scatter into all the winds. Therefore, as I live, saith the Lord Eternal, surely because you defiled my sanctuary with all your detestable things, with all your abominations, therefore I will diminish you, neither shall mine eyes spare, neither will I have any pity. A third part of you will die with the pestilence, that's massive disease epidemics, and with famine shall they be consumed in the midst of thee. And a third part shall fall by the sword, that's a symbol of armies attacking, and of course of military action and of war. And I will scatter a third part into all the winds and draw out a sword after them. They're departed, they flee, they are refugees. Then shall mine anger be accomplished, and I will cause my fury to rest upon them, and I will be comforted, and they shall know that I, the Eternal, have spoken it in my zeal when I have accomplished my fury in them. Moreover, I will make you waste and a reproach among the nations that are round about you in the sight of all that pass by. So it shall be a reproach and a taunt, an instruction and an astonishment unto the nations that are round about thee, when I shall execute judgments in thee in anger and fury and furious rebukes. In chapter 6 and verse 6, in all your dwelling places the cities shall be laid waste. That did not happen when the northern 10 tribes were removed from their land. You read that the deportations of those tribes up to Assyria was taken at the same time that Assyria put other people, which is where you had Samaria during the time of Jesus Christ, because they came from that area of the Babylonian plain, the Tigris-Euphrates Valley. And they were actually moved into it. It was not a scorched earth policy like there is being carried out in Kosovo today. But the dwelling places were left intact, and the people were ordered out and were deported, and then they put other foreigners in their place, which meant that the swarthy Samaritans that were living in that area were still the remnants of some of those who had been transplanted from Babylon and Assyria much earlier. This did not happen during the earlier captivity of the northern 10 tribes. In all your dwelling places, the city shall be laid waste, and the high places shall be made desolate. That's the altars, the Asherim, the groves. And your idols may be broken and cease, and your images may be cut down, and your works may be abolished. The slain shall fall in the midst of you, and you shall know that I am the Lord, the Eternal. Now, how many people know that today? That is stated in the book of Ezekiel 62 times. And they shall know that I am the Eternal. Now, I am is the name by which he revealed himself to Moses. The YHVH or JHVH, which has no consonants in Hebrew, is the word Jehovah. Some want to pronounce it Yahweh, Yahweh, or Yahweh, or however they do it, or Java. There are many different ways that people try to pronounce it. It is wholly unpronounceable in English because there are no consonants. We don't know what consonants to supply. So there is no way to really accurately pronounce it. But look at it technically from what you know about John, the first chapter. The JHVH of the Old Testament, capital letters LORD in the Cambridge Bible, the King James English Bible, connotes the Jehovah, which is the member of Elohim in covenant relationship with his people, who spoke to Moses and who dealt with the patriarchs, the very same individual who was mentioned in John, the first chapter, as the Logos who was with Theos. And Theos includes the JHVH, or it is the exact counterpart of Elohim, more than one, a plural word. And who was the Logos, who was Theos, who was the spokesman, or the Word who was God, who without him was not anything made that was made, and by him was everything made, but the Creator. Do the Jewish people today know the Logos? Or didn't they reject him? It says in chapter 1 of the book of John, he came unto his own, and his own received him not. They rejected him, and they have rejected him to this day. Even then, if you think this means the Jews, which it does not, it means the house of Israel. That tile was a symbol and a sign to all the house of Israel, not to Judah. Then you know, for God to repeat something 62 times, he must be sincere. He must be somehow intent on letting people understand that he means what he says. Do you think that the average person walking the streets of Haifa or Tel Aviv or Jerusalem today knows the individual portrayed in the first chapter of John? Do they know that the Logos is Theos? Do they know the JHVH of the Bible? Do they really know the God of the Bible? They're primarily an irreligious country. Oh, they have all kinds of religious fringes, but the vast majority are irreligious. And on Shabbat, the beaches are filled. I mean, you can see them. That's their big holiday day in Israel today. They're not a religious nation. Just like during the days of Jesus Christ, the religious types are in the distinct minority. You understand that by looking at all the arguments in the Knesset and so on. Now, chapter 6 and in verse 7. The slain will fall in the midst of you, and you shall know that I am the Eternal. Yet I will leave a remnant that you may have some that shall escape the sword among the nations when you shall be scattered throughout the countries. Now, again, keep that place and think about what you're about to read in Isaiah, the 11th chapter. Turn to Isaiah 11. They're going to be scattered throughout the countries. Who is going to be scattered throughout the countries? The house of Israel, but portrayed by a tile that depicted the city of Jerusalem. This is Jerusalem, but it shall be a sign unto the house of Israel. The 11th chapter of Isaiah is a chapter that depicts the beginning of the millennial reign of Christ. It says, a branch out of Jesse will grow, and out the Spirit of the Lord will rest upon him. Verse 2, of wisdom and understanding, of counsel and might, the Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Eternal, and shall make him of quick understanding and the fear of the Eternal. He will not judge after the sight of his eyes, neither reprove after the hearing of his ears, but with righteousness shall he judge the poor, verse 4, and reprove with equity for the meek of the earth, and he shall smite the earth with the rod of his mouth. As I've said, there are millions of Methodists and Baptists who could never even tolerate the idea that Jesus Christ of Nazareth is coming in the wrath of God to administer the death penalty upon people like Milosevic and others who are guilty of mass murder. But the Bible says he will over and over and over again, which proves to me that there are millions of people who profess a Christ that is made in their image of what they think their Christ ought to look like. Man can't create the segment of an earthworm in a laboratory, but he makes gods in the millions. They have an idea of what their God or their Christ is like, but there'd be an awful lot of ladies at any given church supper that would get up and walk out in absolute horrific disdain. Well, I never. If you try to teach them that Jesus Christ is going to come to impose the death penalty on mass murderers, they simply won't believe it. They think the second coming of Christ is going to be an ecstatic, beatific, wonderful time of the rapture. It's going to be a rapturous event. It's going to be war. Horrible war. War where the greatest number of people are going to die than in any war in the history of this world. And they are going to have their flesh consume while they stand and their eyes consume in their sockets, it says in Zechariah 14. So we're talking here about Christ using wonder weapons, super weapons that kill a man and don't even dirty his uniform. How about that? A uniform is there with a man in it, and it collapses in a pile of clothing. There's nothing there but dried bones. It says the flesh will consume off their bones, and their eyes will melt in their holes. That's like the neutron bomb that kills everybody with radiation but leaves the buildings intact. That's what it says in Zechariah 14. He will smite the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips shall he slay the wicked. Now, it goes on to describe the conditions to become extant, verses 6 through 9. Wolves dwelling with the lamb, the leopard with the kid. Snakes are no longer poisonous. A child can play with a rattlesnake. They will not hurt nor destroy, verse 9, meaning men or animals, predators. In all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Eternal as the waters cover the sea. The knowledge of God, absolutely universal and extant everywhere. In that day, upon the time of the second coming of Christ, now he's got a 3 1/2 year ministry he's going to fulfill toward the Gentiles. There shall be a root of Jesse, which shall stand for an ensign to the people, and to it shall the Gentiles seek. And his rest, look at the 4th chapter of the book of Hebrews, shall be glorious. And it shall come to pass in that day that the Lord shall set his hand again the second time to recover the remnant of his people. It lists a little later on who all of them who are. You know, they're not only the Jews, but also the 10 tribes of Israel, which shall be left from Assyria. Modern day Assyria, I believe, is Germany. But even if you think it is modern day Iraq, or a portion of Iraq, or Kurdistan, is it possible that Jewish or other members of the Lost Ten Tribes, captives, could end up in the hands of Arab nations if the destruction of the nation of Israel takes place and massive loss of life takes place and massive deportations take place? Where will they go? Let's read and see where they are. He's going to gather them. If you believe God at all, if you believe Christ at all, if you believe the Bible is the Word of God at all, then you'd better believe that when Jesus Christ stands on this earth, he will be gathering his people. And even if you think it's the Jews, you and I both know that a great war that would destroy the Israelitish nation, the modern nation of Israel, which is Judah, would immediately plunge the entirety of the world, including the United States, into global war. World War III with nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons. You know that, and I know that. So if you believe God at all, you believe that this is Jesus Christ who is going to gather His people. Who are they? I know them to be Americans, and British, and French, and Belgian, and Swiss, and Norwegians, and Danes, and Swedish, and Finns. I know them to be the people of the lost 10 tribes of Israel. But if you think they are only Jews, then I also know them to be people of Judah, of Simeon, and of Levi, who will also suffer the same consequences, perhaps only 1 out of 10 remaining alive. Where will they be? Assyria, and from Egypt, and from Patros, which was Upper Egypt, and from Cush and Elam, and Cush is probably modern-day India, and from Shinar and Hamath and the coastlands of the sea. In other words, all points of the compass, nations all over the earth. He shall set up an ensign for the nations and shall assemble the outcasts of Israel and gather together the dispersed of Judah. Look at the language. Not the outcasts of Israel, parenthesis Judah, but the outcasts of Israel and the dispersed, the diaspora of Judah, from the four corners of the earth. The envy also of Ephraim shall depart, and the adversaries of Judah shall be cut off. There have been decades and decades, centuries of antagonism between the British people and the Jewish people. And if you look back to World War II, when we really began to know what had gone on in all of the concentration camps, and the British with their forts in the land of Israel and trying to prevent mass exoduses of people from all of the European ports, including some of those in the Mediterranean. And matter of fact, the motion picture many years ago, several decades ago, called Exodus, highlighted that very fact. There were people who were dying. They would get in sight of Haifa and they would jump off the ship and try to swim ashore and drown because the British were keeping them out. It's interesting that there's been such antagonism between the British government and Jewish people over the many years, and it says that the envy of Ephraim shall depart and the adversaries of Judah shall be cut off. Ephraim shall not envy Judah, and Judah shall not vex Ephraim. But they shall fly upon the shoulders of the Philistines. The Philistines are Palestine. Palestine. That's what that means. That's where the word comes from. Toward the west. They shall spoil them of the east together. They shall lay their hand upon Moab, Edom and Moab, and the children of Ammon shall obey them. But Edom, Moab, and the children of Ammon are exempted when the king of the north, who is the beast power, comes in to occupy Palestine, according to Daniel 11, 40 to 45. So it is after the time of the second coming of Christ that Edom, if you read the book of Obadiah, and Moab and Ammon come in for their national punishments, and much of which is going to be carried out, believe it or not, by tens of thousands of returning captives who are going to come through those lands and just utterly devastate them for what they did to Judah in the time of its national distress. Read the book of Obadiah. It's absolutely inescapable. And the Eternal will utterly destroy the tongue of the Egyptian Sea. That's the eastern part of the Mediterranean, the seven streams of the Nile. And with his mighty wind shall he shake his hand over the river and shall smite it in the seven streams and make men go over dry shod. And there shall be an highway for the remnant of his people which shall be left. When? Look at the description of animals' natures being changed. Of the second coming of Christ and the beginning of the millennial reign of Christ. When does this happen? Which shall be left from Assyria, like as it was to Israel in the day that he came up out of the land of Egypt. And it says elsewhere that this great exodus is going to pale into insignificance in future history, hundreds of years into the millennium, so that the previous exodus of the book of Exodus will never again be mentioned. It'll be forgotten in the dust of time. But the great exodus that they will keep talking about will be the exodus that is yet future of Australians and New Zealanders and British and Americans, Dutch and Danes, of people from all around the world, Jews and Levites, who will swarm into the Middle East and into their own lands where they'll be replaced according to Ezekiel 36 chapter and repopulate the waste places. And that will become a statement that will be almost like the byword next year in Jerusalem that the Zionist Jews have said at their dinner tables for centuries now. Remember the Exodus of what? 2004, 2011, 2013? I have no idea. But there will be a great exodus, says this scripture, that will actually eclipse the other exodus. Now look at Isaiah 10 and verses 5 to 7. O Assyrian, the rod of mine anger and the staff in their hand is mine indignation. I will send him against an hypocritical nation, and against the people of my wrath will I give him a charge to take the spoil, to take the prey, and to tread them down like the mire of the streets. Howbeit he meaneth not so, neither does his heart think so, but it is in his heart to destroy and to cut off nations, not a few. This is a warlike nation. I have, as a segment of the book, Europe and America in Prophecy, a great deal of information about the origin of the Germanic peoples of Central Europe. Where is Germany mentioned in prophecy? If you haven't read that, by all means do so. Now, in Isaiah 11, though we read that, Isaiah 11, 13, we read the rest of that, and Isaiah 14 now, if you'll turn back to that chapter. Isaiah the 14th chapter, and toward the latter third of that chapter. Verse 24, the Eternal of Hosts has sworn, saying, surely I have thought, so it shall come to pass. As I have purposed, so shall it stand. That I will, listen to this, and you try to find a history book, you can't find it. Not in Josephus, not in Dorothy Ruth Miller, not in Rawlinson's Five Great Empires, not in the Encyclopedia Britannica 11th edition, not in any history book can you find this ever having occurred. That I will break the Assyrian in my land, and upon my mountains tread him underfoot, then shall his yoke depart from off them, and his burden depart from off their shoulders. Now the Assyrians lay a yoke upon the peoples of Israel, the so-called lost 10 tribes. Turn over now to the 47th chapter of the book of Isaiah and see whether or not there is a consort in connection with the military arm of the beast power that is going to accomplish that. Isaiah 47, in verse 1, come down and sit in the dust, O virgin daughter of Babylon. Now, Babylon is called Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth in Revelation 17. And the woman is a picture of a great false church. Sit on the ground. There is no throne, O daughter of the Chaldeans, for you'll no more be called tender and delicate. And then it says in verse 4, as for our Redeemer, the Eternal of Hosts is his name, the Holy One of Israel. Sit thou silent and get thee into darkness, O daughter of the Chaldeans, for you shall no more be called the Lady of kingdoms, the Lady of nations, the Lady of empires. I was wroth with my people. I have polluted mine inheritance and given them into thine hand. You did show them no mercy. Upon the ancient have you very heavily laid thy yoke. And you said, I shall be a lady forever, so that you did not lay these things to your heart. So she boasts that she is eternal. In the 17th chapter of Revelation, it says, the woman is that great city which reigneth over the kings of the earth. And it says that city has seven hills. What city is it? Tokyo? Poughkeepsie? Chicago? Tyler? What city is it that has seven hills, is called the Eternal City, and has reigned over the kings of the earth for centuries and centuries, all since the day of Imperial Rome? Rome itself. Hallie's handbook has quite some sections on that. You did not lay these things to your heart, neither did you understand the latter end of it. Now therefore hear this, you that are given to pleasures, that dwellest carelessly, and saith in thine heart, I am. That's a title of God, and that's an ultimate blasphemy. And none else beside me, same comment, a title of God, an ultimate blasphemy. I shall not sit as a widow. What nation is it that is the fatherland? The Rodina in Russian means the motherland. The United States is always spoken of as she, la belle France, she, a nation, she. Nations are always spoken of as she, except one. Germany has always been called the fatherland. What church is it that has daughters and freely refers to herself as the mother church? There's a mother church and there's a fatherland. I shall not sit as a widow. So there's a marriage. Neither shall I know the loss of children. And there are lots of those who came out protesting against the mother. But these two things shall come to thee in a moment, in one day, the loss of children and widowhood. They shall come upon thee in their perfection, for the multitude of your sorceries and the great abundance of thine enchantments. Now back in Revelation, the 17th chapter, if you will turn to that. The entirety of the 18th chapter also deals with this, the complete destruction eventually of that whole great system. After identifying Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth in verse 5, it says in Revelation 17:6, I saw the woman drunken with the blood of the saints. And I've covered that in recent sermons about the fact that the beast is going to, quote, make war against the saints and to prevail against them, as it says in the 7th chapter of Daniel and in Revelation the 13th chapter. And with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I wondered with great awe, great not admiration in the sense of respect, but just great astonishment. And the angel said unto me, wherefore did you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has the 7 heads and 10 horns. The beast that you saw was and is not, and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit. That's a figure of an abyss or vast multitudes of people, many, many nations, and go into perdition. So the final destruction of it is at the time of the second coming of Christ and the destruction of all of his enemies. And they that dwell on the earth shall wonder, whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they behold the beast that was and is not and yet is. That's where we are right now. Never was that verse more poignantly true and more instantly accurate than right now. It was, we don't see it, and yet it is. And it will become evident in a very short time. Here is the mind which has wisdom. The 7 heads are 7 mountains on which the woman sitteth. And there are 7 kings, 5 are fallen, 1 is, the other is not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short space. It says that they are to receive power together 1 hour with the beast. We'll read in just a moment. And the beast that was and is not, even he is the 8th, an 8th system that is of the 7, and goeth into perdition. Now, verse 12 through 14, I've said time and again, if all you had were these 3 scriptures, you would understand a tremendous amount of what is to take place in the world in the future. The 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings, which have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. These have one mind, that is, they're in complete agreement with one policy, and shall give their power and strength unto the beast. That's their military and their economy and their populations. These shall make war with the Lamb. So the time setting is at the time of the second coming of Christ, and the beast power, consisting of 10 nations, will literally try to fight Christ at his return. But the Lamb will overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings. And you read of how he will do that in Zechariah 14, that miraculous disintegration of human flesh right while they stand that I described that is in that chapter. And they that are with him are called and chosen and faithful. And he saith unto me, the waters which you saw where the whore sits are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues or races or ethnic groups. And the 10 horns which you saw upon the beast, these will hate the whore. Why? Because the beast power itself is to be demolished and destroyed. They will then realize they have been utterly deceived, and that even though a large talking image were to be erected, and the entire world begin to worship it, and to ask it of its advice, if that is to be literally done, and I speculate about that, I cannot say that dogmatically at all, that may never come to pass. Because I know that metaphorically, the little horn that has eyes of a man and a mouth speaking great things is that little state within a state called the papacy that has ruled over the kings of Europe from the days of the Holy Roman Empire until this modern time. And still can have her way over nations by the use of interdiction. And has caused many a would-be despot or a ruler of a nation to be overthrown by the populace itself who fears losing salvation if a papal edict called interdiction, which is national excommunication, should be handed down by the Pope in Rome. They will realize that everything that they had fought for, everything that they had hoped for, their great, beautiful, glittering, huge economy they build up, which is described in the 18th chapter, is destroyed in a moment. And they will turn on what they believe will be the architect of that destruction. They shall hate the whore, and make her desolate and naked, and eat her flesh and burn her with fire. Metaphorical language of the destruction of that great church. For God has put it in their hearts to fulfill His will and to agree and to give their kingdom unto the beast until the words of God shall be fulfilled. And the woman which you saw is that great city which reigneth over the kings of the earth. And the 18th chapter describes the complete destruction of that system. And it says in verse 20, "Rejoice over her, you heavens, and you holy apostles and prophets, for God has avenged you on her. And a mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone and cast it into the sea, saying, Thus with violence shall that great city Babylon be thrown down." And that spiritual Babylon, remember this was written in 92 AD. Babylon fell in 536 BC. That's why the prophecy says Babylon is fallen, because this is relating to a yet future collapse of the entire system called Babylon the Great, as well as the one great city that is over the entire system. "That great city Babylon shall be thrown down and be found no more at all. And the voice of harpers and musicians and of pipers and trumpeters shall be heard no more at all in thee. And no craftsman of whatsoever craft he be shall be found any more in thee. And the sound of a millstone shall be heard no more at all in thee. And the light of a candle shall shine no more at all in thee." In other words, normal commerce, normal life will no more be taking place. "And the voice of the bridegroom and of the bride," no more marriages, no more life as usual, "shall be heard at all. For your merchants were the great men of the earth, for by your sorceries were all nations deceived." So the great economists, and there you are, conspiracy theorists, if you find out anything at all about the Vatican Bank and Marcinkus, and if you find out anything at all about some of the books that have been written revealing who it is who pulls some of the strings of global economics, and who some of these people are, and who is in cooperation with whom, you'll come to understand who are the merchants and the great men of the earth, who are the great bankers, who are the people that really possess the billions of dollars, some of whom have personal wealth more than the GNP of 10 nations put together. "For by thy sorceries were all nations deceived." Is that going to come to pass? Will there be sorceries? Will there be huge signs? Will there be a man sitting in a temple of God, calling himself God, having a power to call down fire from heaven in the sight of men? Will there be an image that will literally speak? Is that literal? Is the Bible true? Is Christ, who is the one who spoke these words and gave them to John, telling us the truth? "By thy sorceries were all nations deceived. And in her was found the blood of prophets and of saints and of all that were slain upon the earth." And so God lays to the door of that great false system all of these wars, all of this loss of life, all these horrible, horrible situations that will become extant in the years that are yet to come. To recap right quickly, recently in a sermon called "The Nations Are Angry," and if those who hear this haven't yet heard that, they're certainly welcome to call for it and to get the audio tape of that sermon, "The Nations Are Angry." If you look back and you try to trace those events that led up to World War II, you will see that first of all, it began with a territorial acquisition by an egocentric maniac who struck at a time when a much more powerful foe, potentially, could have annihilated him. But they psychologically were defeated before they ever even started, because I believe Satan, the devil himself, had entered into the mind of Adolf Hitler. He marched the troops across the bridge with daisies in their rifles, all smiles, the brass band, and all the people greeting him with open arms, when an army that was four times his size, over there a few miles away, lay geared to defensive posture only behind the Maginot Line. Was the beginning of World War II the marching into the Sudetenland and the militarization of the demilitarized zone? Was it the scrapping of the Treaty of Versailles? Was it the Pact of Locarno? Was it Anschluss when Hitler marched into Austria? Was it the marching into Sudetenland and the partitioning of Czechoslovakia? America wasn't involved. It certainly was not Pearl Harbor. That was merely dragging this great nation into a war which had been going on for years, when millions have already died, when millions were being slaughtered in camps in Europe and we knew nothing of it, and those who did know kept it hushed up and said nothing about it. and eventually we were dragged in. Now, we, under our current administration, have precipitated the crisis, have enlarged the crisis, have made it far worse, and instead of saving life, we have hastened the loss of life, and there may be no way to ever undo what has been done. In the first place, there are no villages and no homes for those Kosovars to go home to. Now, who is beginning to bear the burden of taking care of all those refugees? You are, and I am. We are. President Clinton is going to go before the Congress and ask for additional billions upon billions of dollars. There will be additional billions upon billions spent for all those Learjet missiles, the guided missiles that we're running very, very short of now, and the ordnance. And if you think there isn't going to be a draft, well, stand by. You may be surprised. You know, one day when we look back, we may say, yes, World War III really began when Bill Clinton ordered the first bombs to be dropped on Belgrade. Because, you know, it took from 1936 to 1941 for the United States to ever become really involved in that war before we were attacked by the Japanese. It may take years yet. May God spare your children and grandchildren, and even my own grandson, Michael, who is 12, could well be 18 by the time we are deeply involved in ever-expanding wars. What if North Korea attacked today? What if Saddam Hussein moved south and occupied Kuwait today? What if Pakistan and India began a war today? What if the Palestinian Authority declares a unilateral state and the United States is one of the first nations to recognize them? We live in troublous times, don't we? We may look back and say, sometime, yes, World War III has already begun.